This is the second part of a lesson, as you can see, is entitled Spiritual versus Sensual Worship. You may have an idea of the meaning of the word sensual that suggests to you that it is something sexual, and therefore should not even remotely be connected with the idea of worship. If you know anything about New Testament worship or what the New Testament teaches about sensuality or sexuality, and I'm confident that you do. However, I want you to be aware that I'm using the word sensual or sensuality in a much broader sense than simply the sexual sense. And as a matter of fact, I went back to my standard English dictionary just before I came this morning and observed again that the word sensual means having to do with the physical, relating to the five senses, basically, and going from there to mean something of a sexual nature. But it doesn't have to be something of a sexual nature. It can be much broader than that. And it is in that very broad sense that I'm using the word sensuality when I speak of it as opposing spiritual worship. So sensuality then has to do most basically with what appeals to our five physical senses: sight, hearing, smell, taste, and touch. And therefore has to do with our fleshly nature as human beings. Because we are fleshly and enjoy what appeals to our flesh, and we enjoy pleasuring our five physical senses, then we try to move that, our people have throughout history and even up into today, have tried to move that sensual or physical element even into our worship of God, something that we would think is supposed to be profoundly spiritual in nature, that is supposed to shut out as much as possible what is the sensual or physical in nature. And I went on to observe last week that the pagans, as odd as this may sound to us, the idolaters of the past, the pagans, had no idea of separating out from one another the physical or sensual and the spiritual in worship. Now, in these lessons, you should think of spirituality or sensuality as existing on a spectrum or a continuum of some sort, with idolatry or pagan religion existing on one extreme, and pure spirituality coming close to being represented in New Testament worship at the other extreme. And there are various degrees of religion or worship, which captures, again, in varying degrees, either sensuality or spirituality or both. Now, from the very, very beginning, of course, God has observed that human beings are both spiritual in nature. We've been made in the image of God. That is, we have spirits, we have souls, but also we have fleshly bodies. And our spirits and our bodies compete with one another, if you will, for dominance. And there have been times, many times, whether in the lives of nations or individuals, when one or the other has tended to dominate. This was so going back almost to the very beginning. It says in Genesis, the 6th chapter, verse 3, "Then the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. This was before the Lord brought on the flood, which destroyed all of humanity except for 8 persons. So he observes here that, you know, man is not purely spiritual. God is purely spiritual. The flesh does not appeal to him. But human beings are both fleshly and spiritual. So there is that struggle between the spiritual and the fleshly or sensual that always goes on within our lives. And we have to fight to suppress the physical or the sensual, keep it from becoming dominant and determinative in our lives, and exalt as much as possible and allow to predominate that which is spiritual in our lives. Well, as I saw last week, moving on now, this struggle between the spiritual and the sensual or physical plays out in worship also. And we observe, for instance, as I said a while ago, at one extreme of the spectrum, you have pagan or idolatrous worship, which basically made worship fun. And even to the point of bringing what was explicitly and blatantly sexual into it. For instance, we saw that the Israelites in Exodus, the 32nd chapter, upon the golden calf being built for them, sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And so idolatrous or pagan worship, which the Israelites were adopting with the gold, worship of the golden calf at this point, we can see there as an example, could be very sensual in nature. And we looked at a number of other examples of that, basically to demonstrate and stress that pagan worship completely confused sensuality and spirituality. Now, let's move along the continuum now from that pagan or idolatrous worship to Old Testament worship, and then ultimately we will go farther and look at New Testament worship. And let me get over here to where I left off last week. Okay, managed to do that. So we're looking now at worship under the law of Moses, or the Old Covenant, Old Testament. What was it like? Especially when we contrast spiritual and physical elements in it. And I want to observe that the law of Moses combined spiritual and physical or carnal elements within it. It was not completely spiritual, but neither was it as carnal or physical or sensual as pagan worship was. Worship under the law of Moses was physical, carnal, sensual as compared to the New Testament. But as compared to pagan worship, it was very spiritual in nature. Now, it might sound odd to you for me to say that the law, worship under the law of Moses or the Old Testament, was carnal, physical, sensual in nature, as well as spiritual. But that's what the New Testament tells us about. As a matter of fact, if you were to go to Romans 7, verse 14, it says explicitly there, "For we know that the law is spiritual." That's the law of Moses, the Old Testament. The law is spiritual. But then, if you go to the book of Hebrews, which speaks extensively about the Old Testament, you'll see that references are made to it being carnal. And I'm going to read from the old King James Version, which came out in 1611. And I'd like you to look at it with me, Hebrews 9, verse 10, particularly. And the author is writing about the Old Testament system of worship. He says, "Which stood only in meats and drinks and divers washings and carnal ordinances imposed on them until the time of Reformation." Now, whereas Romans 7, verse 14 said that the law is spiritual, here it talks about the carnal ordinances of the Old Testament. That is, those which pertain to the physical body. So again, even the New Testament tells us that there were elements of both the spiritual and the carnal, physical, or sensual in Old Testament worship. There was a combination of the two. So Old Testament worship didn't go all the way to what was purely spiritual in worship. Now, among its outstanding carnal or sensual elements, let me just remind you and go through them fairly quickly, were animal sacrifices, for instance. We don't have animal sacrifices today. Maybe you're glad for that because it involves a lot of blood and gore. Okay? But not only were the animal sacrifices themselves of a physical or sensual nature, but actually the worshipers themselves and the priest probably got to eat most of the bodies of those animals. I shouldn't say probably, I know. Now, there were different kinds of sacrifices. There were what were called whole burnt offerings, in which the entire body of the beast was consumed in the flames on the altar, or maybe outside the camp in fire. But whole burnt offerings weren't the only kinds of animal sacrifices, maybe not even the main kinds of animal sacrifices under the Old Testament system of worship. There were also sin offerings and peace offerings. Now, in those cases, the priest got a big chunk of the animal that was sacrificed and got to eat it, I suppose with his family or other priests. But probably most of the flesh of the animal was eaten by the worshipers themselves. So their worship actually got them a lot of animal meat to eat. Let's go on in recounting some of the fleshly or sensual aspects of the law of Moses. Circumcision, of course, the cutting of the flesh, literally, of a child, male child, 8 days old. There was dancing and instrumental music in use in the Old Testament. There was the physical of the tabernacle or temple, and their worship had the emphasis upon those physical buildings. We don't need to meet in a physical building, do we? As a matter of fact, during the spring and summer, we were meeting outside the building. There's also a geographically designated centralized place for all of the nation of Israel to gather, namely eventually Jerusalem. We don't have a national center of worship or global center of worship where we have to go. And of course, whether you could worship God depended upon your fleshly, your physical descent, whether or not you were descended from God. Maybe I should qualify that a bit. I don't mean to say that the Gentiles could not have worshiped God if they wanted to. But if you were going to be a member of the nation of God's people, namely the Israelites, you had to be a descendant of Abraham for the most part, although there were proselytes or Gentile converts to Judaism in some cases. If you were going to be a priest, you had to be a descendant of Aaron. And even on top of that physical descent, there were other physical qualifications that the priest had to meet. For instance, the law of Moses specified that if they had certain physical deformities in their bodies, they could not serve as priests. So I'm just giving you these examples. I could cite others, but these are some of the primary examples of how the Old Testament worship or system could be physical, carnal, or sensual in nature. But on the other hand, the law of Moses moved away from the fleshliness, the sensuality of pagan worship by making worship more spiritual, much more spiritual and ethical in nature. And it did this by imposing specifications and restrictions on the Israelites in the form of scriptures, instructing them as to how they should worship. For instance, the law of Moses prohibited the use of images in worship. And you're probably aware that, I believe it's, memory serves, it's the second of the Ten Commandments that forbade the use of images. Exodus 20, verses 4 through 6. There's an interesting passage along this line while we're talking about the use of images in worship. When I say images, I don't mean just statues. Today, images or icons can come in the form of paintings, mosaics. Deuteronomy 4, verses 15 and 16. There the Lord is speaking through Moses and says, "So watch yourselves carefully, since you did not see any form on the day the Lord spoke to you at Horeb from the midst of the fire, lest you act corruptly and make a graven image for yourselves in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female." Now, Horeb is another name for Mount Sinai. And what he's saying is, they were not allowed to see God in any form. Now, God expressed himself. It was, you know, a lot of smoke going up from Mount Sinai and so forth, and which caused the people to be, the scene there caused the people to be very fearful. So God expressed himself in some way, but he did not show himself as he was, or at least not in the form of any idol or image from which an idol could be made. He did not show himself in human form. He did not show himself in animal form. So what's Moses saying here? He's saying, you Israelites need to be careful, because in effect what he's saying is, I know about the human craving to see God. And when people can't see their God, they do the next best thing. And they make representations in stone or wood or precious metal and so forth of what their gods might look like, or what they want their gods to look like. So because you didn't visibly see God himself, don't be tempted by that fact to go out and make some image of what you think God looks like or should look like to you. So this stresses the basic desire in human beings to be able to see God. Now, remember, sight is one of the five senses. So in that broad sense again, idolatry or the use of images is something that is central. I remember being told many years ago that one of the objects, for instance, of certain elaborate religions creating large buildings like cathedrals and putting paintings or mosaics on the walls, and even a dome where the ceiling of the dome, interior ceiling of the dome, has representations of angels or Old and New Testament characters, and maybe even God or Christ on it. And that the impression was intended by that to be left upon the worshiper who enters the building and looks up of like he is entering heaven or a heavenly realm, a highly spiritual realm. So he's entering into a situation where there seems then to be a lot of solemnity and really spirituality. Now, what's happening in a situation like that? What's happening, I will tell you, is that people are using the physical, the sensual, to give people the idea that as a result of indulging the sensual more, they are therefore, for that reason, more spiritual. And so again, just like the Old Testament pagans did, they confuse the spiritual with the sensual. They're really different. But the law of Moses, and this is what was so remarkable and what was distinctively divine about the law of Moses, it got away from all of those cultures. Not only in that it was monotheistic, that is, it asserted that there was one God, not many gods, but one God. But also it said, you cannot worship this God, despite what all of the pagans do, what all the other nations do. You cannot worship this God with the use of images. There are not going to be any images. depicting this God. Now, someone has said, well, what about the cherubim, who with their wings were over the Ark of the Covenant, or they were actually part of the mercy seat, which was essentially the lid on the box of the Ark of the Covenant. Now, cherubim are in order of angels. And some people say, well, you got that image there. And also there were cherubim embroidered into the curtains of the tabernacle. Well, let me observe this about that. Only the priest ever got to see those cherubim on the curtains of the tabernacle, because the people were not allowed to go into the tabernacle or the temple. Okay? So only a very small portion of the Israelites, namely the priest, ever saw them to begin with. What about the cherubim with their wings overspreading the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant? Well, only one person, namely the high priest, ever got to go into the Holy of Holies, the innermost compartment of the tabernacle or temple, and see those cherubim. And he only once a year on the Day of Atonement. So for all practical purposes, Israelites never saw these images. The average Israelite never saw them. The law stressed that the rituals of sacrifice, even though they were important, they did not displace obedience. They did not displace the need to be ethical, moral people. There are so many passages that we could look at to this effect, but remember what is said in 1 Samuel 15, verse 22. Has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, Samuel told King Saul. So he said, listen, what you do physically with these sacrifices, they don't mean anything to God, if you don't obey him. So the law looked forward to a time of reformation, when worship would be even more spiritualized than under the new covenant, would be more spiritualized under the new covenant. Now, the Old Testament, as we've observed, was indeed spiritual, moral, ethical, but not wholly so. There were carnal elements involved in it. We've already listed some of these. But even Jesus in John 4, verse 24 says, an hour is coming when those who worship the Father will worship him in spirit and truth. And he even said, listen, this was to the Samaritan woman at the well. He said, you know, people won't be worshiping here on this mountain. He was referring to Mount Gerizim, where the Samaritans worship. People won't be worshiping in Jerusalem. What he meant was that there won't be particular places like that where people have to gather to worship God. That physical, that sensual element is going to be done away with under the new covenant. And this was prophesied of the new covenant in Jeremiah 31, verses 31 through 34, where it says the Lord would write his laws. He would bring in a new covenant, and in doing so, write his laws upon the hearts of the people. So this was something that that was to be taken into people's hearts. And there was not going to be that level of emphasis upon getting things physically right, as was the case under the law of Moses. So having said that, let's move on now to look at the New Testament and its worship. New Testament worship virtually eliminates all of the distinctively sensual elements of either pagan or mosaical worship. By mosaical worship, I mean Old Testament worship. I say virtually eliminates all of the physical elements. Not entirely. Because, as we'll see, there are still some physical elements even involved in New Testament worship. But there is nothing in the New Testament about worship which includes a particular place. We don't have to go to, say, Washington, D.C. or Jerusalem, Paris, London, Beijing, or someplace else in the world to worship God. We can worship God with our brothers and sisters in Christ in our own localities. So that's something that is different. New Testament worship did not include the use of images or instrumental music. They had that in the Old Testament. You know, some people want to say, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit to say this, but a lot of people want to justify what they do and what is supposed to be New Testament worship by going to the Old Testament. Instrumental music is one of them. And they would go to Psalm 149 and Psalm 150, which refer to instrumental music and worship. And as I was saying last week, although instrumental music is not wrong per se, there is a more sensual element involved in the use of instruments in worship. They tend to excite people. And people mistake this greater level of excitement as greater spirituality. And that's a mistake. It is not. It's just more sensuality that is parading itself as greater spirituality. But anyway, in Ephesians, the fifth chapter, and actually if we start with verse 18, that would be better because it points out a contrast to what might have been involved in pagan worship and then the worship of Christians on the other hand. Ephesians 5, beginning with verse 18. And do not get drunk with wine, for that is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit. You know, there was a god of wine among the Romans, Bacchus, and a cult, religious cult, developed around him. You know how they honored or worshipped or celebrated Bacchus, the god of wine? By getting drunk. By getting drunk. Paul may be alluding to that. He said, you know, when you engage in your worship, don't get drunk. And don't think that if you do get drunk, you're being filled with the Spirit of God. You're not. Instead, verse 19, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody with your heart to the Lord, not with instrumental music, but with your heart involved. Not with your fingers strumming on some instrument, but with your heart, strumming the strings of your heart, so to speak, and singing. New Testament worship eliminated dancing. It eliminated animal sacrifices. It eliminated burning incense. It eliminated a separate priesthood. It eliminated circumcision. You know, there's an interesting passage as we talk about the transition from the Old Testament to the New Testament and their respective forms of worship. And speaking of the transition from sensuality to spirituality, there's an interesting passage along those lines in Romans 2, verse 29. I don't have it on the screen here. But notice this very explicitly states how that from the Old Testament to the New Testament, there is a spiritualizing of things which were carnal or physical. Paul says, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly. That means spiritually, we're spiritual Jews. And circumcision is that which is of the heart, by the Spirit, not by the letter. And his praise is not from men, but from God. Indeed, those who desire to incorporate sensual elements into the church and its worship, what do? They look to the Old Testament for justification. I remember when I was preparing this lesson, I was doing some reading online about the use of images that certain religions or churches make, even those who might think of themselves as being Christians. You know what they do, how they justify it? I've already mentioned it, really. They go back to things in the Old Testament like the cherubim over the mercy seat on the Ark of the Covenant. And I'm thinking, really? Don't you appreciate the fact that there has been a transition from the Old Testament to the New Testament and what that involves, especially in terms of worship. There's a change there. Do you not recognize that? In fact, it was strictly forbidden, to give you an example, to mix common meals with worship. And the New Testament has no feast comparable to those which were in the Old Testament. Now, people were used to the idea of worship involving, getting to eat, having a feast. And they had their feast days in the Old Testament. We don't have anything like that under the new covenant of Christ. Nothing like that. As a matter of fact, this was something that the pagans were very used to. Paul says something about Christians who think they could do so being observed dining in an idol's temple. Yes, the idol's temples apparently were like restaurants practically. You could go in there and have a nice meal perhaps, thinking you were honoring your God in eating that meal. So, yeah, like I said, it could be fun to be a pagan idolater. And even in the Old Testament, as I said, there were feasts which involved eating food. Do we have anything like that in the New Testament? Why no? No. Here's an interesting contrast in 1 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, verses 7 and 8. We do have a feast, though, but it's a spiritual feast. And Paul brings this out very clearly in 1 Corinthians 5, verses 7 and 8. And he's not talking about the Lord's Supper here. Let me say that ahead of time. Observe what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5, verses 7 and 8. Clean out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, just as you are, in fact, unleavened. For Christ our Passover also has been sacrificed. Let us therefore celebrate the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Yes, we have a feast to celebrate, and we have bread with that feast. But what does Paul say is that bread? It is the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. When we live our lives and when we worship God is in a sincere and truthful way, that is the feast we are celebrating. When we enjoy from day to day, day after day, the benefits of Christ's sacrifice and the forgiveness of our sins and the salvation of our souls, we are celebrating the feast. It is a spiritual feast, not a physical one. And in recognition of that, while we're here in 1 Corinthians, the 11th chapter, let's look at verses 22 and 34 of that chapter. Now, the Corinthian brethren had been idolaters, Gentiles largely. They'd been converted out of the ways of pagan idolatry, where they were used to having these feasts and actually physically consuming the flesh of animals that had been sacrificed to their false gods. That's what they had been accustomed to. And perhaps they thought the Lord's Supper was to be something comparable to that. Well, it was not. They abused the Lord's Supper, apparently trying to make a what they would think of as a real feast, a physical one, out of it. Paul says, no. As a matter of fact, you're not even supposed to eat at all a common meal when you come to worship and partake of the Lord's Supper. That's, by the way, why we only have small bits of bread and just a little grape juice when we partake of the Lord's Supper, because it was a memorial meal. Not a meal intended to satisfy our physical hunger. So in verse 11, verse 22 of 1 Corinthians 11, he says, what? Do you not have houses in which to eat and drink? And then he eventually says in verse 34, the last verse of the chapter, if anyone is hungry, let him eat at home. And then if you were to go to Acts 2, verse 46, which I won't take the time to read now, you see that the Christians there in Jerusalem worshiped in one place, namely the temple or the temple precincts where they gathered as a church. But when they wanted to eat common meals, they broke up into groups and went to their private homes for that. there was a distinction made between eating the physical food at home and enjoying the spiritual feast in worship to God. New Testament worship also was to be conducted not as a raucous, revelrous affair, as was the case in pagan worship. Rather, it was to be done in a decent and very orderly fashion, as it says, particularly in 1 Corinthians 14, verse 40. The closest thing we have in the New Testament as to a picture of what worship looked like in the churches of the first century, what it was supposed to look like, is 1 Corinthians, the 14th chapter. And Paul lays down rules there. He says, only so many prophets are to prophesy at one time, and if people speak in tongues, it's, one at a time and so forth and so on. So it was to be done in a very orderly fashion, in a fashion that was, I suppose, maybe too sedate for some people today. And that brings up the next point. Instead of people really appreciating the difference between Old Testament worship or pagan worship and New Testament worship, they try to reintroduce Old Testament and even pagan elements, sensual elements, into the worship of the New Testament church. And so what? You have now images, crosses, icons, even in those churches that won't permit little statues in the building and so forth. They will at least, you go into any even relatively conservative Protestant denominational building today, you will find at least one cross there. They still want the visual there, the sensual there, even if it's just in a relatively small way. Then, of course, you have the instrumental music. In some cases, you have the burning of incense. Of course, you have the eating of meals, even with my own brethren in many cases. They will mix the eating of common meals and the Lord's Supper in the same venue. The point of the scriptures is you want to carve out of your life and out of the life of the church, just a few hours in the week when you can get together and get away, shut out the physical for just a little while, relatively speaking, and indulge in what is as purely spiritual as you can. That's the real underlying problem with having a kitchen and dining facilities and common meals in the same location where you worship. Because you're mixing the carnal or the sensual there with what is supposed to be spiritual. And you're giving into the carnal. You're fostering and encouraging. You're promoting. You're elevating the carnal when you do something like that. And you're perhaps drawing in people because of the carnal there. I'm not opposed to eating by any means. I'm not opposed to brethren getting together and having social occasions when they can eat. I'm not opposed to that at all. That's a good thing. But we don't want to leave the impression that you can be more spiritual by indulging in the carnal. We want to make a distinction. That's important sometimes. There is even dancing involved, even in some churches that would consider themselves to be Christians. But it's interesting, and I was reading about this, you probably heard, or perhaps have heard, of the whirling dervishes in Turkey. They are Sufis. The Sufi sect is part of Islam. And these men, it seems like it's exclusively men, will get out on what we would think would be a dance floor, and their long skirts, they will spin. They will pivot on one foot with the other foot, turn themselves in a circle constantly. And in doing that, they will work themselves into a trance, if I understand it, or some meditative state, higher meditative state. And then after whirling for a while or spinning for a while, they will go off in some room and meditate in a more physically calm way. And that's their way of getting in touch with God. That's sensuality, really. They're using the sensual. They're confusing the sensual with the spiritual. They think that by using this physical act, they can get themselves into a greater spiritual state. Now, all of these things I've mentioned, in some cases, might be justified as aids to devotion and worship, but they do the very opposite of what they are intended to do. Instead of increasing spirituality in the form of obedience to God, they focus spirituality on and define it by experience or feelings. In other words, they make the same mistake the pagans made in thinking that the extent to which they are able to make themselves feel like they are spiritual, then they think they are spiritual. And that's not the case at all, necessarily. You know, Jesus didn't put the emphasis upon, let me back up a little bit here. Jesus in John 13:35 and 14:15 didn't put the emphasis upon how we feel as to whether or not we're truly good Christians. He said, by this will all men know that you are disciples, if you have love for one another. And he also said in John 14, verse 15, that loving God is keeping his commandments, obedience. That's what it is. So he's saying, you know, don't measure your spirituality by the level of excitement you achieve by going to some worship service that is really more like, almost more like a rock concert, a music concert, the New Testament worship. Don't think that because you are inclined to raise your hands and pray to God and so forth in situations like that, that therefore you must be more spiritual. And that's what God wants out of you. No, the New Testament doesn't say anything like that. As I close, let me give the example that Jerry Balk has given me of the experience that he and the other members of the church in Perth Amboy have had for months, I suppose, if not years. He has told me that perhaps they've had to move the times of their Sunday worship on multiple occasions, more than once, probably too, right? You know why? They meet in something like a storefront out there in Perth Amboy. Well, right next door with just a wall separating the two groups, there is a Pentecostal church meeting there. And Jerry tells me that they make so much racket. I mean, they really turn up the volume with their instrumental music. They make so much noise that even the wall is not enough to keep the sound out and keep it from disturbing them in their worship. I'm talking about the worship of the members of the Perth Amboy Church. So in order to avoid a clash like that, they've actually had to change the times of their worship on more than one occasion so that this loud, noisy group next door, who think they're more spiritual evidently because they are so loud with their instrumental music, so that they can worship in peace and calm without all of that noise disturbing them. Jerry tells me that he has gone so far to as to approach the woman pastor about it next door. She's been rude to him. And when he has asked her perhaps to tone it down some, we can't even hear ourselves think next door with all this noise going on. She has said, this is what the people want. This is what they like. You know, what's happening there? They're reverting to paganism, basically. That's not greater spirituality. They may think they're more spiritual because they're louder. But you don't measure spirituality like that according to the New Testament. They're not paying attention to what the New Testament teaches. Let me close out now with a conclusion here. Though the New Testament largely transitions from the fleshly to the spiritual, it's interesting to know that even New Testament worship does not entirely eliminate the fleshly. That may surprise you for me to say that. But just think about it for a moment. We human beings are fleshly. We're spirit and flesh. And so there's an overlap between spirituality and sensuality to a certain degree. Though more limited, the physical is still employed in New Testament worship in the promotion of the spiritual. Do we have anything physical here? Sure. Well, we ourselves are physical. Our physical bodies are brought together into one another's presence. We have small physical elements in the form of the grape juice and the bread. We sing hymns, which can be pleasing to our ears. So, and perhaps you can list other ways. So the physical is not absolutely entirely eliminated even from New Testament worship. And some have tried to do this even more. I have read that at least in the past, the Quakers or the Society of Friends, members of the Society of Friends, have tried to make worship even more spiritual by eliminating the singing of hymns from their worship. Now, we don't sing hymns right now. I hope we'll be able to do so soon, but we don't sing hymns right now because we don't want to spread around the coronavirus anymore. So, as I said at the beginning of the lesson, spirituality in worship exists on a spectrum or continuum. And we Christians are not at the end of that spectrum. Yeah. The New Testament is just one iteration of spirituality, though it's a greater one than that found in the Old Testament. Certainly greater than that found among pagans in their worship. The final shift to full spirituality occurs in the transition from earth to heaven. Passages such as 1 Corinthians 15, verse 50 teach this. Flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of heaven. When we go to heaven, there, finally, we'll achieve the purely spiritual. In the meantime, let's be careful to maintain that standard, that level, that definition of spirituality in our worship that the New Testament gives to it. Thank you.